interesting and exciting, and it's also a little bit challenging, which I like a bit of a challenge sometimes. So Ezekiel's temple is probably thought of as one of the most difficult sections of the Bible to understand. Many people tend to avoid it as a class simply because it seems very difficult to grasp in the way that it is laid out for us. What is really interesting is that the temple is a reoccurring thing throughout the Old and the New Testament. The temple starts out as a tabernacle. It's then improved upon and expanded by Solomon, and lastly will be further improved upon and expanded in the kingdom age. The tabernacle, Solomon's temple, and Ezekiel's temple are the only three buildings in the Bible that are given to us in such great amount of detail that we have a great and exact detailed picture of them. And basically what God has given us is a blueprint of each building. However, this is not what makes it hard to understand. What is difficult is that we're not provided any kind of a picture to go along with the measurements that we're given. So that makes it a little bit more daunting when you're looking at it. And you really need to visualize what is being given to you in your mind and then put it down on paper as you go along. However, once you begin to understand what is going on, it really begins to come to life and you can see it for what it really is. It's not simply a temple that's given. There's a whole reasoning as to why and what is happening in the temple at the kingdom age, which is also included in Ezekiel 40 to 48. And it goes along perfectly with a few other things in the Bible that we will talk about. But to really understand the temple, you can't just start talking about measurements and drawing a picture. First, we have to look at some things that are going on in the Bible that support the view of the temple as it stands in here in order to clear up a few misconceptions that people may have. So I've got five main topics that we're going to go through. The first one is God builds things up and changes them, but does not replace them. Why? Because God never makes mistakes. He always has a plan, and this is evident in his plan for Ezekiel's temple. Three temples. What are the common reoccurring items in them, and why? How are the temples expanded upon, and why? How will worship occur in the temple, and how does it affect the dimensions given? And then lastly, which we won't cover tonight, we'll cover in the next class, which is the building itself, bringing it to life. So the first topic, there are a number of things in the Bible that God builds upon or adds to. Sometimes they're changed slightly, but they are never completely done away with or replaced. This is because God knows the beginning and the end. He knew exactly what was going to happen when he created Adam and Eve. He knew that he would have to sacrifice his son on the cross. He knew that there would be a judgment and a kingdom age. This is because God exists out of our perceived understanding of time and space. Revelation 1 verse 8 states, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the last. He is everything, he created everything, and it is impossible for him to make mistakes." So when he gives a command, when he works in our lives, and when he wrote the Bible, he knows what will happen. He knew what would happen. He also knows that we would fail. He knows that we would read it and either spend a lifetime trying to understand it and read it, or that we would reject it. So here are a few good examples of God putting things in the Bible that are built upon. The first one is, and I'm sure Jeremy, well, he's not in here, right? He's in another room, but I think he'll appreciate this because it builds upon his class talking about threes. Three great covenants in the Bible, the Abrahamic, the Mosaic, and the Davidic. God promised Abraham a land and a people. He then built upon his promise to Abraham in the Mosaic covenant. He gives them a law and promises to greatly bless them if they keep and obey his law and to serve him only. And finally, the Davidic covenant, where God promises an eternal kingship through David, pointing to the Lord Jesus Christ. All of these promises build upon the other to form a true nation. If you did not have one of these items, you wouldn't have a true nation. You would have a tribe, a nomadic people, or barbarians. The original covenant, is never changed in any way, but is built up on and added to suit his will and his purpose. The next thing I want to take a look at is the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were given to the Israelites for them to keep and to follow. However, it was something that was also impossible to completely follow due to sin nature. This doesn't mean that the law was flawed in any way. There was absolutely nothing wrong with the law itself. But there was in sin nature. So what was the change that was made by Christ? Christ gave us two laws in replacement for the Ten Commandments in Mark 12, verses 30 to 31. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And the second is like, namely this. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these. These two commandments did not replace the law, but they complemented it. If you follow these two great commandments, then you have fulfilled the Ten Commandments. Christ states this in Matthew 22, verse 40. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Again, this is built up but not changed. The last example is the example of the temple, which is the one that we're going to talk mainly about. And as I hope you will see, we have a continual building up of the original format. The tabernacle was the most basic form of the building, and it was mobile for an extremely good reason. They would be carrying it around for the next 40 years as they traveled around in the wilderness and also when they first settled in the land. However, it still had some basic characteristics about it that are carried into the next two temples and that are described in great detail in the Bible. Each temple has a defining boundary around it. In the first tabernacle, it was a cloth barrier, and then the second two, it's a wall around it. This separates what is holy inside the temple or the tabernacle from what is unholy outside of the tabernacle and temple. Each temple has a specific holy and most holy place inside the building, with a defining separation in between each of them. However, the third simply, instead of a curtain, has a wall with a two-leafed door on it. Lastly, each temple has an altar to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. The tabernacle is listed in Exodus 30, verses 1 to 4. I'm not going to read these because it will take a long time. Solomon's temple is in 2 Chronicles 4, verse 1. And Ezekiel's temple is Ezekiel 43, verses 13 to 17. So how are these temples expanded upon? And what reason is it expanded upon? The tabernacle was mobile, so it had to be built small and easy to disassemble for transport. However, when Solomon built the first permanent temple, the size of it was greatly increased to allow for an increase in the amount of sacrifice and the amount of people that would be able to go in and worship. And what it did was it allowed people to really start to take part in the worshiping of God because they could go into the temple. They could see things that were going on. All of the things that were included in the tabernacle were included in the next temple, the holy, the most holy places, the laver, showbread, the Ark of the Covenant, etc. We have the same basic structure that we had in the first temple. However, there are some changes to things, especially in the third temple, Ezekiel's temple. The description that we have in Ezekiel's temple allows for greater volume due to the new gates in the north and the south, as well as an increase in the number of buildings. This gives the final temple a lot more versatility. It is not stated what all of the buildings are for, and there is even a sacred building that is described and is completely unknown as to what the purpose of it is for, what will be done with it, what it will hold, or who will be allowed to go in it. So there's a little bit of mystery there as well. We will get a little bit more detail into this in the second class, however. So how will worship occur in the temple? Does this affect the dimensions and size that we see in Ezekiel's temple? Will everybody be going up to the temple every year to worship? And as I went through and studied Ezekiel's temple, I came to the conclusion that not everybody would be going up to the temple every year to worship. And I have a few reasons for this. Based upon how the Bible talks about worshiping in the temple, and the previous and other examples in the temple of Bible worship and language that is used, especially in Ezekiel describing the offerings and the feasts that will be kept. Let's go to 1 Samuel 1, verses 1 to 3. Now there was a certain man of Ramathim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Joram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. So it states that Elkanah and Hannah went up, well, specifically Elkanah went up yearly to worship in the temple. This is something that I think is not normal for this time period. It notes that the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there. They were the two priests that caused Israel to sin. People in those days basically did whatever they would wanted in their own eyes. So the temple was probably fairly empty most of the time. So it was customary for the men to go up three times a year for the feasts. However, it doesn't mention that the women or children needed to go up every year. They were allowed to go up, but it was not a requirement. Let's go to Exodus 34, verses 23 to 24. Thrice in the year shall all your men children appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. For I will cast out the nations before thee, and enlarge thy borders. Neither shall any man desire thy land, when thou shalt go up to appear before the Lord thy God thrice in the year. So here it states that men were supposed to go up three times a year to the temple or the tabernacle. This was a requirement for the Jews only, however. It never mentions in the Bible anything about the rest of the world going up to appear three times in the temple. And we will certainly not be required to go up to the temple three times a year to worship. However, I'm sure it definitely wouldn't be a bad thing. Hannah, it mentions, does not go up with Elkanah to the temple once she bears Samuel. She is not required to go up to the temple each year. She is a woman, and women did not have this three times yearly requirement. It is notable, however, that it states that she does not go up with Elkanah in 1 Samuel 1, verse 22. Does this make her unrighteous or less righteous because she doesn't go up? Absolutely not. Hannah was probably one of the most faithful women in the Bible. Because of that, God granted the request that she prayed so earnestly for. That was because she had a great amount of faith. Let's take a look at Zechariah chapter 14, verse 16. And take note of the language that's used in here. It's extremely important. And it shall come to pass that every one that is left of all the nations which came up against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. It states that every one that is left of the nations that came up against Jerusalem will go up to the year to worship year by year. I don't doubt that there will be few left of these nations to go up to the temple to worship after Armageddon, not only because so many people will die there, but also of the plagues that God lists that he will send upon these countries. So here in Zechariah 14, verse 16, it states that everybody in these specific countries will be required to go worship at the temple every year. However, in the next few verses, is this still the case with the rest of the countries in the world? Let's take a look at verse 17. And it shall be that whoso will not come up out of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship, the king, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. So the word of note here is families. This is still a plural thing, but it's changed slightly. Now instead of everybody, it's talking about families. Let's take a look at verse 18. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, there shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So now we have the singular word, the family of Egypt. So what is this telling us? The family of Egypt. I'm going to suggest that this is the ruling class of Egypt or the government. The nation of Egypt will have to send specific delegates or representatives of the country to the temple to worship every single year. Now I'm going to point out a few verses that supports this theory, because obviously one verse is never enough to cement something or to prove something. Let's take a look at what it says in Isaiah 60, verses 11 to 12. Therefore thy gates shall be open continually. They shall not be shut day nor night, that men may bring unto thee the forces of the Gentiles, and that their kings may be brought. The forces is actually rendered wealth in other versions of the Bible. I'm reading from the King James Version. The New King James Version says wealth. So here we have a delegation bringing gifts to the temple with the kings of that nation that sends them. Let's take a look at Revelation 21, verse 24. And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor unto it. In Revelation 21, this is actually talking about the post-millennial age. However, I believe the same principle applies to the millennial age. The kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor unto it. It doesn't list all of the people. It lists specifically the kings. These countries will certainly have to pick carefully who comes up to worship, to show obedience to Christ and to show obedience to God. I believe that there is still sin in the world. If a country sends a delegate that does not meet certain requirements, then they're going to have a serious problem. Remember what it said about what would happen to Egypt if they did not go up. They will have no rain, as well as God will send plagues upon those countries. So why delegates from the nations and not every single person? Does this mean that only delegates from the nations will come up to the temple to worship? Absolutely not. Everybody who wants to go can go anytime they want, but there's a requirement of those people that come up, and it's a pretty serious requirement, and it applies to the nation's delegates as well as the common people. Let's look at Ezekiel 44, verse 9. Thus saith the Lord God, no stranger, uncircumcised in heart, nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary of any stranger that is among the children of Israel. What does it mean to be circumcised of heart? I think that Paul gives a pretty good example of what this means in Romans 7. Verses 15 to 20. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that do I not. But what I hate, that do I. If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. For I know that in me, that is, in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. For the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. Now if I do that I would not, it is sin no more that I do it. It is sin no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. Paul was ashamed of the things that he did. He hated his sin nature. He hated the things that he did that he didn't want to do. And because of that, he was an extremely humble man. That's what it means to be circumcised of heart. And that's how we should feel about ourselves. But do we always feel that way? Probably not most of the time. Would we be allowed to enter the temple the way we are most of the time today? Some of us, yes. Perhaps some of us, no. That's something to think about. Do we feel ashamed around the memorial feast on Sunday? Are we ashamed when we're late to Bible class because we didn't wake up early enough, or we didn't set enough time to get ready, or simply didn't think that it was important to go? Are we all guilty of this from time to time? Absolutely. Thankfully, God doesn't feel the same way about us, or we would be in serious trouble. So why would the Bible say that those entering the temple had to be circumcised of heart and flesh if sin has been completely done away with in the earth? Well, that's because it has not been completely done away with. Sin has been subdued for a season, for 1,000 years. But what does this mean? This means that the nations have been subdued. Christ's and God's laws will reign supreme over all the earth, and those nations will submit to God for that 1,000 years. However, there will still be people that will secretly hate Christ. They will hate the laws that they're forced to obey, and they will hate the Jews. We see this in Revelation 20, verses 7 to 9. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. And he shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Is this something that's going to happen all of a sudden? No. This is something that will be planned. This will be a planned rebellion, and it will take a long time to plan. This is not something that people wake up one day and think that they're tired of Christ reigning as king. This is something that happens slowly. People will hate the way of life that is imposed on them. We see that people have still not learned, even after 1,000 years of paradise that they have experienced. That's because people are greedy, selfish, and sinful. They will want things to be like they were before, like they are today, where every man does what seemeth good in his own eyes. So because sin nature will still exist in the world, we will have to have a second judgment and resurrection. In Revelation 20, verse 12 to 15. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it. And death and hell delivered them up, the dead which were in them. And they were judged every man according to their works. And the death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Here we have a second resurrection and a second judging. We wouldn't need that if there was no sin in the earth, because people will still have free will to choose to serve God or to rebel and to choose sin. Sin has been happening the entire 1,000 years, but it has not been allowed to rebel against Christ until the 1,000 years is up. So the next thing that we on our list that we need to know about the temple is the feasts and the sacrifices. So what are the sacrifices on the feasts? I hope to have a slide of this, but unfortunately I didn't have enough time. But there I have a list. The first day of the first month. A young bullock without blemish to cleanse the sanctuary. That's in Ezekiel 45, verse 18. The next one is on the seventh day of the first month. And you were supposed to do the same as the first day for those that unintentionally sin. Ezekiel 45, verse 20. The 14th day of the first month is the Passover. And Christ is supposed to prepare a bullock for a sin offering. Ezekiel 45, verse 21. Then we have the 15th to the 21st day of the first month, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. 7 bullocks and 7 rams without blemish each day for a burnt offering, as well as a grain offering of 1 ephah with a hin of oil for each bullock and ram, and a kid of the goats daily for a sin offering. The King James Version renders the grain offering is the meat offering, but it's simply a grain offering with a hint of oil. The 15th to the 21st day of the seventh month. This is the same as the feast of unleavened bread, which I just mentioned, Ezekiel 45, verse 25. And then on the Sabbath, once a week on the Sabbath, the priest shall offer 6 lambs with a grain offering, with a hint of oil as much as desired, and 1 ram with a grain offering of 1 ephah and a hin of oil per ephah. This is for every Sabbath in a year. There's also a new moon feast. Once per month at the beginning of each new moon, the prince shall offer 6 lambs with a grain offering as much as desired and a hin of oil per ephah. 1 young bull with a grain offering of one hin of oil and 1 ram with a grain offering of 1 ephah and a hin of oil per ephah. And then lastly, for festivals and appointed days, the sacrifice for bulls is 1 ephah and 1 hin of oil. For lambs, the grain offering is as much as desired with a hin of oil per ephah. And for rams, the grain offering is 1 ephah and a hin of oil. So what's the point of these festivals? This is to show that there will not be an overabundance of offerings where the priest cannot keep up with the demand for offerings on a daily basis. Many people will come to the temple to worship voluntarily, however, but not all will have to bring sacrifices, and not all will be allowed entry into the temple. Those that do come voluntarily can bring offerings, or they can simply worship at the feast days or festivals. So what happens if we have a day where there's too many people bringing offerings and the temple begins to back up? Because the altar doesn't have enough space and cannot burn the offerings fast enough. Well, I think that this would sort of be like doubting God's power. Let's take a look at Elijah with the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings 18, verses 38 to 39. And then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, He is the God. The Lord, He is the God." The offering here is instantly burned up in the fire that God supplies. Is it a stretch to say that this kind of fire could be seen in temple worship? I don't think so. I think that it's entirely reasonable to assume that God will burn sacrifices used here just as quickly if needed. This poses another problem, however. The heat from the fire would be unimaginably hot. The fire that Elijah experienced burnt up the sacrifice, the wood, and the water. So won't the priests who are preparing and putting the sacrifices get burned? I doubt that. Let's use the example that we have in Daniel. Daniel and his three friends are cast into the burning fiery furnace when they do not worship the image set up by the king. However, they're not harmed at all. God sends an angel to protect them, and not only are they completely unharmed by it, they don't even smell like fire. I think that quite possibly God would do the same and give the same protection to the priests who are offering sacrifices on the altar, as he did in Daniel. So now that we have a bit of a better understanding on who will go up to the temple to worship and why and how the sacrifices are made, we can really look at the temple building itself. We know that the entire world will not be going up to the temple to worship because sin is still in the world, albeit greatly subdued under Christ's rule, and there is not an overabundance of people offering sacrifices to the point that it would overflow the altar. This concludes my first class on Ezekiel's temple. If anybody has any questions, you're welcome to ask them, and hopefully I can answer them. If not, I'll try to answer them next class. Okay. I did consider Herod's temple, and well, it's actually Nehemiah's temple, but it's basically the same dimensions as Solomon's temple. The reason why I didn't mention it is because it's not mentioned in great detail. But there's really no difference to it. And Herod's temple, though it was great, it was expanded upon, doesn't really fit in with. I know that some people suggest that Herod's temple is actually what is listed in Ezekiel, and it doesn't fit in at all with Ezekiel's description of it. I hope that answers your question. It does? Okay. Any other questions? No? Okay.